You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickert is out today. 50 years ago, this month, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed into law the Medicare and Medicaid programs, and with it changed the face of healthcare in America for generations to come. Today, Medicare and Medicaid cover almost a third of all Americans, well over 100 million people. While these programs have brought medical care to the majority of the country's poor and elderly people, they have also received criticism from across the political spectrum over those 50 years. To look at the history and future of Medicare and Medicaid, we have with us now Julian Zelizer and Keith Whalew. They're both professors of history and public affairs at Princeton University. They're also editors of Medicare and Medicaid at 50, America's Entitlement Programs in the Age of Affordable Care. Julian, welcome to the show. And Keith Whalew, thanks for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's start with the basics. A lot of times I think we slur them together, Medicare and Medicaid, as one word or use them interchangeably. Keith, can you start off by separating what does Medicare do? What does Medicaid do?
So we use them one after the other because they were passed simultaneously, but they have very, very different origins. Medicare, of course, is the program that covers health care for the elderly, for people over 65. It's signed into law on the 30th of July, 1965, and it has four different parts that it's acquired over the course of years: hospital insurance, medical insurance, Medicare Advantage, which came along in the 1990s, and then the prescription drug benefit, with which George W. Bush signed into law during his presidency. Medicaid has a kind of a legacy as a program for the poor, unlike Medicare, which is paid out of dedicated payroll taxes. So people have a sense that they paid in and they get out. Medicaid has long had the stigma of being a welfare program, and it's a program that depends on a combination of federal funding and states deciding to buy into the program to support the health access to health care for people both in poverty and then increasingly people over the poverty levels, in some cases 100% and more over the poverty level. The history is that, of course, Medicare was the centerpiece of that legislation in 65, and Medicaid was sort of an afterthought. It was thrown in the last minute by the House Ways and Means chairman in order to kind of scuttle opposition, and they both end up being really centerpieces of the U.S.'s commitment to the health care of the vulnerable 50 years later.
And with the recent passage of the Affordable Care Act, often called Obamacare, it was contentious, a rocky road to passage. Some people compare it and think back, oh, it wasn't easy and smooth sailing like back when Congress knew how to pass things. Julian, in your piece in this book, you say, no, this was really contentious. It was a rocky road to pass Medicare and Medicaid in the first place.
Yeah, I think we forget what the atmosphere was like in 1963 and 1964. The year before this passes, the American Medical Association attacks Medicare as socialized medicine, which is the term you don't want to be tagged with during the height of the Cold War. They conduct a massive campaign to kill the program. The AMA sends pamphlets to physicians' offices that are posted, which warn people who are leaving their doctors, if this bill passes, a bureaucrat is going to be making decisions about your health care rather than your doctor. And there's also conservatives in Congress, Southern Democrats who control the committees, like Wilbur Mills of the Ways and Means Committee, teaming up with Republicans, and they killed the proposal every time it came up for a vote under Kennedy, and even during Johnson's first year. So, you know, from the perspective of 1964, it still seemed low probability that this program was going to pass.
What put it over the top, Julian?
Well, most important was the election of 1964 creates huge liberal Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate, 295 Democrats in the House, 68 Democrats in the Senate, and many of the newly elected members were promising and eager to pass Medicare, regardless of what Lyndon Johnson did. And Barry Goldwater, who's defeated against Johnson in 64, one of the issues the Democrats really kill him on is that he opposed Medicare. So many Republicans come out of the election saying, We have to pass something. And the Southern Democrats who controlled the committee said, if we don't do this, the liberals are going to roll us in, and we're going to be on the losing side of this issue. So that election really changes everything.
Now, Keith, you started to touch on how these programs have changed over the years. Can you take us briefly up to the Affordable Care Act? How did Medicare and Medicaid grow in that period?
Well, the subsequent history of Medicaid was uncertain because it always depended on states signing on. And 5 years later, in 1969, more than a handful of states, I think it was about 12 states, had not yet signed on to Medicaid, including New Jersey. 1977, there was only one holdout, and that was Arizona, which ultimately signed on to Medicaid in 1982. So if you think that the slow progress by which states accept Medicaid expansion today is unusual, it's not. I think it's much quicker from 65 to 69 and into the 70s. But it gives you a sense of how this kind of commitment to health care, health access for the poor and people above the poverty line was growing in fits and starts in those first decades. I think the key issue, of course, is that it dawns on state governments as well as the federal government that there's a huge price tag associated with this federal and federal-state commitment. And as early as the early 70s and certainly by the mid-70s, there's an increasing anxiety about whether this commitment is sustainable, whether it's fiscally sustainable, and what it will do to the overall budgets in states as well as in the federal government. And in some ways, the politics of Medicare and Medicaid get tied into the broader politics of liberals and the conservative government, conservative ascendancy in the late 1970s into the 1980s.
Talking to Julian Zelizer and Keith Whalew from Princeton University, editors of the book Medicare and Medicaid at 50. This month is the 50th anniversary of the passage of Medicare and Medicaid. Julian, as you described the debate 50 years ago, leading up to a passage this month, 50 years ago, it sounded a lot like the debates over the Affordable Care Act. How much did the debate over Obamacare reiterate these arguments that we were having 50-plus years ago?
Well, some of it was the same. So conservatives in both periods, and they were different then, they included Southern Democrats. Today it's primarily Republicans, used the same kind of arguments that a program which really wasn't going to take over national health care, they said that it would. They compared it with the kinds of health care programs then, and we did with ACA, that other countries have, that the United States shouldn't have. And they often use the argument that doing this would impede the freedom that Americans have to choose the doctors they want. But the current debate was different. Most important, Medicare and Medicaid are the laws of the land and they're huge programs. So when we were debating ACA, the reality is the government already does a lot of health care. And that's why some Tea Party Republicans were warning and opposing Obama's proposal by saying, get your government hands off my Medicare, warning that there would be cuts in those programs. So I think the landscape's changed. Health care's changed from the expansion of managed care to new kinds of technology that make treatment different. So we should be cognizant of the different landscape in which we are.
And Keith, in your piece in Medicare and Medicaid at 50, you talk about regardless of election day rhetoric, both parties, maybe for different reasons, kept expanding the scope of Medicare and Medicaid from the Clinton era on up to today.
That's true. I mean, you have to look past the easy rhetoric that says that that liberals are always in favor of larger government programs and conservatives are not. And the historical reality is that under Nixon, we have a dramatic increase in a new Medicare benefit for end-stage renal disease for people with kidney failure. George W. Bush, of course, establishes the prescription drug benefit, mostly driven by those sort of electoral realities, the desire to kind of bring the elderly over to the Republican camp and have a durable Republican majority. You also have even Ronald Reagan, who begins his career really characterizing Medicare as socialism, working in tandem with the AMA. In the 1980s, he reluctantly signs on to different forms of Medicare and Medicaid expansion, and in some ways not so reluctantly. So you have the situation where both liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, have, despite whatever the rhetoric might suggest, embrace various forms of expansion, sometimes for their own electoral purposes, and also an acknowledgement of the fact that in a certain way these programs remain very popular. Popular not just with the beneficiaries, but also popular with the hospitals that derive a great deal of income from these programs, that have residency programs financed by these programs. In other words, there's a lot of spin-off into the private market that has benefited from these programs over the course of the decades. And this is something that I think any political figure has to contend with.
We're talking about the impact of Medicare and Medicaid on the 50-year anniversary this month of the signing into law of both those programs. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How have Medicare and Medicaid shaped the United States? Have they benefited you or someone you know? Do you worry that they're an entitlement that diminishes personal responsibility? Maybe they cost too much regardless of the benefit. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or call in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue our conversation with Julian Zelizer and Keith Whalew. They're both professors at Princeton University. We'll continue the conversation after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On the 50th anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid this month, we're looking at the impact of these programs and their future, and we want to hear from you. Has Medicare or Medicaid helped you or someone maybe in your family? What do you think about the future of these programs as they've been changed under the Affordable Care Act, extended? What could the government do to rein in health care costs under these programs? Or do you just have a question about how these work and the politics surrounding them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Keith Whalew, professor of history with the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton, and Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs, also at Princeton. They are co-editors of Medicare and Medicaid at 50, America's Entitlement Programs in the Age of Affordable Care. Julian, costs of these programs, as they've been expanded over time, as they've been changed, a new subsidies added under the Affordable Care Act, is there a sense that Medicare and Medicaid costs are going to be sustainable in 10, 20, 30 years?
Well, there is. I mean, look, these are costly programs. Not only do they cost a lot now and cost more into the future, but they're taking up a bigger portion of the budget. And so that's become a debate. You know, do we spend too much on Social Security and Medicare compared to other kinds of programs when there's limited resources available? It's important to remember that Medicare and Social Security do draw from the payroll tax, not from general tax money. That's the Social Security tax. And the payback is big. And so we can't just talk about a dollar cost, but we have to talk about the kind of impact these programs have on providing the elderly with health care, on the kind of money hospitals and doctors derive from the existence of these programs. So we have to contain costs. We've gone through periods where in the 1980s we tightened regulations. But overall, I think these are actually programs that are doing pretty well.
And Keith, let's talk about that impact a little more. How have Medicare and Medicaid changed the way healthcare works, the way healthcare is delivered in the United States?
Well, it's a little, I guess, discussed fact that things like the existence of nursing homes would not be as, they wouldn't be as prevalent without the kind of programs that exist, the kind of support that exists under Medicare and Medicaid, for that matter. And, you know, on the topic of the rising costs, it's also not as appreciated as it ought to be that Medicare went from being a fee-for-service reimbursement system where a physician would decide what the customary charge for a particular procedure would be. And in the early days, you would just bill and Medicare would pay it. In the 70s and 80s, Medicare came up with a fundamental innovation that has become part of the private insurance market as well, called diagnosis-related groups, DRGs, an approach to paying hospitals that says that, you know, for a particular diagnostic criteria, rather than paying you based on what you've done, we pay you based on what is normal within this diagnosis, and we actually exercise a certain amount of cost containment power by doing so. It's a large program that can wield its power to try to contain costs, and it's the model that's been taken up and carried forward not only within Medicare but also in the private sector. So the issue with Medicare and Medicaid is that they actually have the numbers of people covered to wield that kind of power to contain costs. And really, it's a political question whether they are allowed to do so, whether they're allowed to take those formidable 66 million people covered by Medicaid, 66 and counting, and 55 million and counting in Medicare, and actually use the power of numbers to contain costs. And it's something that there's been a pitched political battle over the last 20 years or so, and that's likely to continue.
Right. That's been an issue with pharmaceutical companies. A lot of advocates saying, hey, use this bargaining power to bargain for lower costs on medications, as you mentioned, millions of people in the program. That still hasn't happened. Do you think, Keith, that's going to change, those kind of negotiations and bargaining will happen in the future?
Well, I think it would be, given we have to reach a point, we will reach a point when the fiscal climate, when the monetary demands of these programs almost dictate that we have to use that bargaining power wisely. I mean, one of the byproducts of the Affordable Care Act is the creation of something called the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, in which we're trying to look at what does quality medicine look like in Medicare and Medicaid? What are good models for pursuing good quality rather than just sort of spending whenever we feel it necessary to? What are sort of, you know, good models that can be carried from one Medicaid program to another? So I guess what I'm getting at is that the power of numbers might help us to constrain costs, but also wise medical practice using models from one state in another might help us to constrain costs over time. But ultimately, I think there has to be a political will to allow Medicare and Medicaid to use the power of those numbers for bargaining.
Talking to Julian Zelizer and Keith Whalew. They are co-editors of the book Medicare and Medicaid at 50. Well, I want to look toward the future with a little lens from the past, Julian. Keith was saying earlier, after Medicaid was passed, states were slow to adopt it. Some states not even signing on for 10, even in one case, almost 20 years. Well, now the Affordable Care Act is in place. Not all states have adopted their own exchanges. Not all states have expanded Medicaid as is available under the Affordable Care Act. Do you think that this is going to be a similar pattern where it's not a permanent rejection? States are going to straggle in over the next 10, 15, 20 years?
I think the odds are yes. And so in some of the states where the Medicaid expansion has not yet taken place, you already see a lot of pressure from Republican governors to accept the money. They're battling with state legislators usually. And you're also seeing a lot of pressure from healthcare providers to take this federal money and take the benefits that come with it. So I think between that and the benefits that come from the exchanges, there is a good likelihood that we'll see what we saw with Medicaid replicated, not only these programs taking hold, but actually expanding and becoming stronger.
I want to talk about the politics going back to before the period you cover in your book. Healthcare efforts have taken a long time. They've been highly contentious issues before, during, and after their passage, whether we're talking about Medicare and Medicaid or the Affordable Care Act. Julian, why is this such a contentious topic in American national politics?
Well, look, we developed a private healthcare system very early on in the 19th and 20th century. Physicians organized in the AMA very early, and before government programs were really introduced, we had a full-blown private healthcare system take shape. So every effort to push for strong federal intervention has had to take place over this private healthcare system, which kept getting bigger and bigger. And the government's also subsidized the private healthcare systems through tax breaks to companies. So I think this is a big part of why it's been hard to simply replace this big program. And then it's become symbolically the issue that many conservatives use to fight against big government.
And let me just add one thing to that, which is the irony of it is that the way we expand healthcare in this country isn't by socializing medicine. It's by creating programs that allow vulnerable citizens like the elderly and the poor to purchase healthcare with benefits to the private sector so that after Medicare was passed, it benefited cardiology dramatically. Medicare Part B insured this group of physicians, excluding it didn't include checkups, but it meant that procedure-oriented specialists like cardiologists, particularly those who dealt with the above 65 group, procedure-oriented, technology-oriented specialists benefited hugely. It really fueled the growth of cardiology in the 1960s.
And we'll leave it at that point. Thanks to Julian Zelizer and Keith Whalew, co-editors of Medicare and Medicaid at 50.